All right, let's move on to our first of the different views of Genesis, what's called Young Earth Creationism. This is usually abbreviated as YEC, Young Earth Creationism, or what some call it as Mature Creationism, that the universe was created in a mature state. When Adam was created, he was created as a, I don't know, at least hit puberty because he was able to have sex with Eve. So 15, 20, 30, I don't know how old he was. And so they would say so too when Eve was created. She was created as a grown woman. She's called Isha, woman in Hebrew. And so they would argue that the entire material universe existed, and it existed sometime, I don't know, 6 to 10,000 years ago, and it was created in a mature state. So, whereas the vast, overwhelming consensus of cosmologists, physicists, geologists, and so forth would argue that the universe is 13.6 billion years old, and the Earth is 4.5 billion years old, and life started 3.8 billion years ago. Young Earth creationism says, no, none of that's true. The Earth was created somewhere between 6 and 10,000 years ago. Famous adherents to this view in the modern day would be Henry Morris, who was an engineer, Dwayne Gish, and most recently Ken Ham, who debated Bill Nye on national television, of all places. Ken Ham runs If Biologos is the think tank for theistic evolutionists, and If Biologos is on one extreme of the Genesis perspective, Ken Ham would be on the complete polar opposite, and his think tank is called Answers in Genesis. And if you type in any biblical question, sure enough, Answers in Genesis is going to pop up on the first page. What do we think about young earth creationism? Well, let's think through some of their arguments. One argument they have is that if you believe in an old earth, that the earth, as I said, was 4.5 billion years old, you're breaking from what the Bible's teaching. They would say, at the very least, that is very, very false and maybe even heretical. And it's definitely breaking from biblical inerrancy. See, there's a problem with this. When we think about the Chicago Statement on the inerrancy of the Bible, the majority of signers, signatories of that document, 240 of the best and brightest in the evangelical world, the majority were old earth creationists. In fact, Norm Geisler says that Augustine, in the 4th century, he's one of the great minds of the Christian church throughout history, B.B. Warfield, the guy from Princeton, Princetonian, John Walvoord, Francis Schaeffer, Gleason Archer, Hugh Ross, I mean, some of the best minds and believers in the Bible and the inerrancy of the Bible believe in an old earth. So it's just not true. It's just simply not true. Young earth creationists would argue, well, if, you know, God is all powerful, he's omnipotent. Omni means all, potent means power. If he's all powerful, why did it take him billions of years to create life and create the universe? Good question. My professor, in my graduate work, as he was talking about this subject, he asked this question. He said, how many people here believe that God could have created the world and the universe in 6 24-hour days? How many people here believe that? And I myself raised my hand, as I think every good Christian should. How many people believe God could have done that? Of course, he's all powerful. If he wanted to do that, he could have. But then he asked the question. He said, well, if he did it in 6 24-hour days, why did it take him that long? If he could do it that quickly, why didn't he do it in 6 milliseconds? In other words, no matter how you slice it, God was working through a passage of time. So an omnipotent God to work over the course of 168 hours or 7 consecutive days, that's still a lot of time for an omnipotent being who could have done it instantly. In fact, we would argue that time is only an issue if God were limited by time or resources. But is God limited by time? No. He's eternal. Jude 25. He existed before time. Is he limited by resources? No. He's omnipotent. So waiting 13 billion years to an omnipotent God isn't limiting him whatsoever. In fact, Hugh Ross makes the argument, he says, many people, when they get married, they spend a year in engagement, or a year and a half in engagement, and tens and thousands of dollars. I can't relate to that. We got engaged for 3 months, and we spent, I think, $2,000 on our wedding. Wow, we went cheap and quick. But a lot of people, they'll spend a year, they'll spend $30,000 on their wedding. And he says, why do they do that? He says they spend a full year just for a couple hours of a ceremony. He says basically what that's communicating is that that ceremony and that event is very, very, very important. Now, is it possible that they could just go down to the courthouse and get married? Yeah, you could do that. But does it communicate something of the preciousness of that event if you wait and you prepare? And yeah, that's what we're trying to communicate. Well, the same thing could be true here as well, that God has been waiting for 13 billion years, and he's been setting up all of these different things to create life, fossil fuels, habitable planet, and everything else. And now we're living in the few thousand years where finally it matters and Christ has come. This shows that it actually could make perfect sense as to why God would wait. Young Earth creationists say, well, what about the genealogies in the book of Genesis? It was Bishop James Usher in the 17th century who went through and he added up all of the genealogies in Genesis chapters 5 and 11 and added up how long did Adam live? 930 years, is it? And then he gave birth to Seth. And then how long did he live? 800 some. And then Enosh. And I'm kind of spitballing here, but you go through Genesis chapter 5, and then Genesis 11, and then you add up all those different ages, and what you come to is that the earth was created 4004 BC. So that's where you get the idea that the earth originated 6,000 years ago, right there. There's a problem with this, however. The word in Hebrew for father, Ab, shortened, or Abba, can be translated father, grandfather, or even great-grandfather. That when it says that so-and-so was the father of so-and-so, that could mean the father, the grandfather, or the great-grandfather. Moreover, when we read through the Bible and the genealogies, I've been in 1 Chronicles for what seems like years now, and 1 Chronicles 1 through 9 is just genealogy after genealogy. Notice here, though, in 1 Chronicles 3:11, Joram is the great-grandfather of Azariah or Uzziah. It was a different name. It's like John or Jack today. When we read in Matthew 1:8, Joram is not the great-grandfather of Uzziah. Joram is the father of Uzziah. So which is it? If the genealogies are supposed to be chronologies, if we're supposed to, the intent of these is that we're supposed to add these up end to end to find out how old the earth is, then why is it that Matthew says that Joram was the father of Uzziah when 1 Chronicles 3 says that he was the great-grandfather of Uzziah? Let me put the screws to you even more. What does it mean in Matthew 1 where it says that Jesus was the son of Abraham? There were 2,000 years before between Jesus and Abraham. What does it mean that he's the son of David? There was 1,000 years between David and Jesus. These genealogies are not chronologies. They show descent. They do not show dating. These are not intended, that the type of literature that they are is not intended to show dating. It just simply is outside of the ballpark. In fact, the Bible never gives us a date of when the earth was created. It doesn't. What this is an inference, and it's a poor one. What about another argument? Some people say, from a young earth creationist camp, they say, old earthers, basically, you're just compromising to modern science. See, when dinosaurs were discovered, and fossilization was discovered, and modern science really took off, and archaeology really took off in the 19th century, it was argued that the earth is really, really, really old. And so, as old earthers, you're just compromising what the Bible teaches to fit with what science teaches. Not true. Not true. Here's Terence Fredheim. He himself is a young earth creationist. And this is from the book edited by Ronald Youngblood called The Genesis Debate. Here's what he says. Now, this is a young earther. He says, while recent scientific developments may have intensified the debate in many ways, the issue of the interpretation of the days of Genesis 1 is almost as old as the church itself. So how long has the debate over the days in Genesis 1 been going? He says, almost as old as the Christian church. And he's right. Justin Martyr, Basil of Caesarea, Origen, who really shouldn't be cited because he himself was a heretic, Augustine held that the days were incredibly long and large. And we see this all throughout church history, that people believed that the days of Genesis were actually very long and the universe is very old. In fact, the Hebrew word for day is the word yom. The word day, yom, has a big semantic range. You know what I mean by that? That's one word, but it can mean a lot of different things. Kind of like our modern word running. Is your nose running? Are you running for president? Are you running down the street? Are you running a company? It has a wide semantic range. And the word yom in Hebrew is the same way. The word yom is the only word that they could have used to describe a long period of time. So when you look at the 3,000 to 6,000 word Hebrew vocabulary, if one was to pick a word to describe a long period of time, yom was the only word that one could use. Second, the Old Testament uses yom, day, to refer to a long period of time. Where, you might ask? Here's one example, Hosea 6:2. He will revive us after 2 days. He will raise us up on the third day. Now, in the context of Hosea chapter 6, this is referring to God coming back and regathering the Israelites. Is this referring to 48 and 72 hours? No, this is referring to a big, long process. And what is interesting about this passage is that the word yom is also being used with ordinal numbers. First day, second day, third day. On the second day, he will return. Or on the third day, he will raise us up. Same thing is true in the book of Genesis. What about Psalm 90, verse 4? For 1,000 years in your sight, Lord, are like yesterday, yom, when it passes by, or as a watch in the night. Do you know who wrote Psalm 90 according to the superscription? Moses. Do you know who wrote the book of Genesis? Moses. The same author in a different text using the word yom to describe 1,000 year period. Now he says it's like 1,000 years. That's the language of simile. But it's showing that this word can be used for a long period of time. Third, Genesis mentions the growth of plants. Genesis 2:9, it says that God caused to grow every tree. Now I know that we all live in the city and we're city dwellers, but we know how long it takes for a tree to grow, yes? A long time. Like if you planted a little sapling and waited for an apple tree to grow, that would take a long time, yes? What about when it says in Genesis 1:11 and 12, let the earth bring forth plants and seeds according to its kind? How long does it take for these to grow? What would the original audience have thought? Now they weren't city slickers like us. They worked with the land. They were agriculturalists. They knew how long it took for trees to grow and for seed-bearing plants to sprout. They knew that this referred to a long time. And this, are we to imagine that the original audience or the original author believed that this was all happening in a 24-hour period? To believe that, you'd have to have them thinking that this was on like some kind of a speed photography, like you get when it, you know, goes from like day to night, night to day, over and over, that this is on like fast forward. That this is just completely out of step with what an original audience would have thought. Fourth, the sun isn't created until day 4. This is a real difficulty, because to say that we can date these days to 24-hour periods, where do we even get the concept of a 24-hour period if not for the revolution of the earth around the sun? But under a young earth view, the sun isn't created until day 4. Therefore, we don't have cosmic time until day four. Fifth, the term at last, and this one's my favorite. It's not the best, it's just my favorite because I think it's funny. The term at last is used when Adam first sees Eve. So on day number six, God does all these things. He brings all the animals to Adam. Adam's figuring out that there's not a suitable helper here. He doesn't match with any of the animals. They all match with each other, but he's like, where's my date to the dance? He's looking around and there's no helper. And then finally, God puts him to sleep, pulls out a rib, creates Eve. When Adam sees Eve for the first time, he uses the Hebrew term hapa'am. Hapa'am. It means at last. Think Etta James here. At last, my love. And he sees her and okay, at last, I've been waiting 12 hours to meet you, baby. At last, that's the word he uses? No, the same word is used in Genesis 29, when Leah had to wait to give birth after many years. It's used in Genesis 46 of Israel, seeing Joseph after many years of separation. How long was Joseph missing? Decades. And he says, at last, hapa'am. And when Adam sees Eve, he says, hapa'am, at last. One more point. Genesis 2:4. Here's a clincher. Genesis 2:4. This is the account, Toledot. This is the account of how God made the heavens and the earth in the day he created them. Wait a minute. Genesis 1:1 to 2:3 says that it took him 7 days to create the heavens and the earth. Genesis 2:4 says it was one yom, one day. So was it 168 hours or was it 24 hours? Which one? How about when it says that there was evening and morning and there was one day, referring to the 12 hours of sunlight? So a day is 12 hours, or is it 24 hours, or is it 168 hours? How about the fact that day number 7 is never completed? You ever notice that? We're still, according to Hebrews 4, in the 7th day of creation. We were born into God's rest, not into works. So according to the book of Hebrews, we are still in that final day. That's not a 24-hour day. Well, what about the science? Well, so far, if you've noticed, we haven't even gotten into the science. We've only been looking at the scripture and the arguments for young earth creationism. They would say, well, the earth doesn't actually date to billions of years old. Yes, it does. This is all across the board. Let's think about, now, we're looking at multiple different scientific disciplines. For this to be wrong, you would have to have every scientist on earth misinterpreting their field in exactly the same way and coming in under the same exact falsehood. The different ways of dating, across the board, it's all coming in with the same answer that's wrong. It's like a global conspiracy if the earth is only 10,000 years old. Think about it like this. You got the Andromeda Galaxy. This is 2.5 million light years away. So if the earth is 10,000 years old and light coming from the Andromeda Galaxy, if it was only traveling for 10,000 years, we wouldn't even see the Andromeda Galaxy, right? We wouldn't see it because it's 2.5 million light years away. So the light wouldn't even reach us. We wouldn't even know it was there. But the light has reached us, and we know that it's not like 10,000 light years away. I mean, that's really, really, really close. And this is the nearest other galaxy out there. So does this mean that God started those photons and light particles 10,000 light years away, like right here, so that they would travel and what? And show us a galaxy that isn't there? You see the problems? What about varves in sedimentary rock? This is sedimentary, meaning sediment, where it builds up year after year after year after year. And the annual seasons of weather, varves are basically sediment and sand that builds up in a rock bed, and there are millions of these layers. And you can track them by each season. So God wanted to create sedimentary rock, and he put all these layers in here, which we can still observe continue to grow year by year. What about the continents? Have you ever looked at the continents? You ever noticed how South America fits in with Africa right there? That's kind of interesting. And North America fits in right above it. This is what they refer to as Pangea, one continent, pan meaning all. So one earth, and this all fits together. Well, the continents moved apart some 200 million years ago. I can't even remember. And they only move apart about 2 to 5 centimeters per year. So this all happened 10,000 years ago. That's what we're saying. But God just made it look like these connect in like a perfect jigsaw puzzle. Coral reefs. These corals secrete calcium carbonate to create the coral reefs. And they only grow a few centimeters a year. And yet some coral reefs are nearly a mile deep. That's 5,200 feet. That's 160,934 centimeters. And they just made them look like they were really old. So, I mean, everywhere we're looking, not to mention radioactive decay, where different isotopes and radioactive materials have a certain half-life and shelf life where they decay at a certain rate. And there are some 40 of these techniques. This is not just carbon or one of the other elements. This is right across the board, and these all decay at different rates. And young Earth creationists say, yeah, but that one test says that it, you know, it gets us to 13.7, or in the case of the Earth, this is geology, it gets us to 4.5 billion years ago, but this other test says 4.3 billion years ago. I'll tell you what it's not saying. No test has ever come in that said 10,000 years ago. All of these 40 techniques get us within the same time period. So much so that in the book, Three Views on Creation and Evolution, Paul Nelson and John Mark Reynolds, now these are two men whom I respect incredibly, very intelligent, very well-read, very educated, but in this area they have the theological conviction that the earth is young. But look at what they write. They say natural science at the moment seems to overwhelmingly point to an old cosmos. That's true. Though creationist scientists have suggested some evidences for a recent cosmos, none are widely accepted as true. It is safe to say that most recent creationists are motivated by religious concerns. Boy, that is true. See, under their view, this is the way they would argue. They would say, you know, I didn't see that the sun stand still in Joshua 10. I didn't see Noah on the ark. I didn't see Jonah in the belly of the great whale. I didn't see any of that. And yet I believe that the Bible is reliable. And I've got a bunch of apologetics for that that would say the Bible is reliable. And so I didn't see this. And I can't line it up with science. And yet I believe what the Bible's saying is true. The problem is this is an incredibly narrow, restricted interpretation of what the Bible says. Remember we said we could be fallible interpreters of science or we could be fallible interpreters of Scripture. This would be a case of the latter, not of the former. This also leads to a terrible problem that God would be theologically a deceiver. Because he's making the light look like it traveled 2.5 million light years from Andromeda when it didn't. He made the coral reefs look like they had been growing for, you know, millions of years when they weren't. He made it look like the barbs were creating and the ice cores. I mean, we could roll out evidence on this all night long. He made it look like it's really old when it's not. And the Bible says that we can look out at the world and the heavens are declaring the glory of God. Day by day, they pour forth speech. Night by night, they pour forth knowledge. God is revealing who he is through nature. And under this view, he is lying to us. He is deceiving us. And that is a terrible view of God to hold. So this view, too, has its consequences. What about the old earth view? What is sometimes called the day-age view. This is the view held by Hugh Ross, Gleason Archer, Francis Schaeffer. Day-age creationism. Can you figure out what it means? It means that each day in the Genesis account is an age of time, a big span of time. That's why we come up with an old earth. That when there was evening and morning the first day, that was probably like, you know, billions of years. And there's evening and morning the second day, that could have been millions of years. And so this is referring to a long span of time. I'm not going to get into the evidences for this view because we just covered young earth creationism. And by talking about the evidence for young earth and against it, we kind of already covered this view. So I'll give some more problems with the old earth view or day age view. There's a difficulty with the language. not with yom per se, but with the evening and morning language, if these are supposed to be describing long periods of time, why would the author use evening and morning? That kind of sounds like a normal day, not like a couple billion years. You know what I'm saying? Well, again, we would have to point out that days 1 through 3 existed before the sun exists. So whatever this language is of evening and morning, this can't be in the sense that we're used to, that the sun is setting and the sun is rising, because there was no sun, or at least a visible sun. Yet old earth creationists would argue that the sun doesn't appear until day 4, that it existed, but you couldn't see it through the mantle because the atmosphere was so darkened and opaque. Old earth creationists would argue that man goes forth to his work and to his labor until evening, Psalm 104:23. Psalm 104 is an interesting psalm because it's a psalm on creation. And so to say that man goes to work until evening, maybe that's the same concept here as with God, that he's working, and then there was evening, and then there was morning. It's interesting it doesn't say that there was morning and then there was evening. That would be like a typical day. It's he's working, and then there's evening, and he quits, and then there was morning. Or you think about Moses, how he performed his work, quote, from the morning until the evening. That'd be the opposite. Why is it that it's evening and morning? Under this view, this is a device to describe the ending and the beginning of something new in between the big ages of time. Number 2, there's a difficulty on the old earth view with the order of creation. You see, when we look at the natural sciences, seed-bearing plants, angiosperms, these don't exist until 370 million years ago on day 3 of the creation account. And land animals, which apparently are created on day 6, they were created 380 million years ago before the seed-bearing plants. But wait a minute, that's out of order. It should be that the land animals are on day 3 and then the seed-bearing plants are on day 6. And so that doesn't seem to make sense. That's out of order. This is a difficulty. Old earthers usually retort that the Hebrew language lacks technical rigor. When it refers to seed-bearing plants, what does that mean? God had just created light and darkness. He just created the sky and the waters below. And then he creates seed-bearing plants. Some would argue, like Hugh Ross, that these are just some kind of self-replicating animal life, maybe amoebas even, something very tiny. He's not sure, but he argues from the Hebrew, which he's done quite a bit of study on. He's not an expert on it, but citing from the theological workbook of the Old Testament or Halot or any of these, that this word for seed-bearing plants could refer to just kind of a self-replicating organism. It could also be that these days overlap, that perhaps this isn't an exhaustive account, that maybe some of these organisms and marine life, terrestrial life, that they were started on a certain day, but it wasn't pointed out in the Genesis text, but it's basically covering the major life events. That's another response I've heard. It's a difficulty. Another difficulty is that when you look at Exodus 20, verses 9 through 11, Moses compares God's creation days in Genesis 1 with the typical 24-hour days for the work week. So just as the Lord worked 6 days and rested a seventh, so you too, Israel, should work 6 days and rest a seventh. And so young earthers would say, see, that just doesn't fit with the day-age view. Because this, you're saying God worked billions of years and then rested however much longer, 50,000 since he created humans, and yet he's comparing in Exodus 20 that we're supposed to work 24-hour day weeks and 168 hours total. How's that supposed to fit? Well, old earthers would retort, they would say when Exodus 20 is citing Genesis 1, it's citing it as a pattern. Obviously, it's not saying that we're supposed to work the way God worked, right? How did God work? God worked by creating things from nothing, ex nihilo, out of nothing. God worked from creating matter, from non-matter. That's not analogous. But what is analogous is just as God worked and then rested, so you too should work. And so to say that this is making a technical argument for how long the days of creation were really misses the point, that Moses is hearkening back to the pattern, not to the chronology. In fact, we see the pattern of seven used quite frequently throughout the Old Testament. Like where? Well, like the year of Jubilee, that you work for 7 years and seven times seven is 49, and then you take the 50th year off. And it's a pattern. It's a pattern which fits the work week. It's a pattern which fits the year of Jubilee. It's a pattern which fits also releasing servants from being indentured to you. The same thing. And that's the pattern being followed, not the chronology. Let's think through another interpretation called the gap theory. If you've never heard of this one, hold on to your seats, because this is an interesting theory. The gap theory is basically this, that you have Genesis 1:1, and you have a perfectly created earth. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Then the earth went through a period of destruction, and then Genesis 1:2 is not a description of how the earth was created, but how the earth was recreated. This is also called the recreation view. In other words, there is an indefinite gap, hence the gap theory, a gap of time between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2. Where is this gap? Where are you getting this from? Remember, we've said before, if you're going to cite a gap in Scripture, the burden of proof rests on you to demonstrate why there's a gap. Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Or it could be translated, as the NIV 84 translated it, now the earth became formless and empty. So under this view, God created the heavens and the earth, and there was a gap of time. And how do we know that? Because the earth became formless and empty. How'd that happen? How did it happen? What happened? Some people say, well, it was Satan. Satan had a fall in between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2. Some people say that it was some kind of a demonic rebellion. Maybe God created things that rebelled before humans. That's what the gap theorist would say. Most tie it to the fall of Satan, however. So why is there all this animal death and plant death, and why are there all these hominins and the Homo erectus and everything else? That was all in the gap. Now, there's another argument here, one which is stronger. Most Hebrew grammarians don't agree with this. The earth became formless and void. In fact, the new NIV translation doesn't even leave this in the footnote. So most grammarians in Hebrew wouldn't agree with this. But most would agree with this. In the beginning, God created. This is a perfect, completed tense. So instead of this being a thesis statement, this is saying that God did this, but then the text telescopes into the planet Earth. So he created the universe, verse 1, and then we don't know how much time went by. It doesn't say. Until you pick up in verse 2, now the earth was formless and void. So anything could have happened in between then. If you want a good read on that, you know what to pick up? John Lennox, 7 days that divide the world. That's his big argument. And he's saying to the young earth crowd, he says, look, we don't know how much time happened between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2. And he cites a Hebrew scholar, C. John Collins, who argues that is the perfect completed tense. It was created, and we don't know how much time transpired. Let's just go with that just to have fun here, though. Okay, now the earth became formless and empty. Let's argue that there. Under this view, Genesis 1:2 is describing a ruined creation. Now, most people, when they first hear about the gap theory, they laugh at it. They say, oh, that's ridiculous. And then you start to hear it explained further and further, and you're like, that's kind of ridiculous. And then you start to think about it more, and you're like, I guess it's possible. And then you think about it a little bit more and more, and you're like, that could actually be true. That actually might be the theory. Stick with me, okay? Before you just write this off as, oh, this is ridiculous. Okay, Genesis 1:2. The earth became formless and void. Where do we know that language from? And darkness was over the surface of the deep. Darkness is usually described as something which is bad, formless and void. The Hebrew term tohu wabohu, which is just fantastic to say. Tohu wabohu, formless and void. When you read about this in the rest of the Bible, particularly Isaiah 34 and Jeremiah 4, to be tohu wabohu, formless and void, is a sign of destruction. It's a sign of judgment. So God created the heavens and the earth became tohu wabohu, became under judgment, destroyed. Something bad happened in verse 2. Isaiah 45:18, the Lord created the heavens. Now read this very carefully. He is the God who formed the earth and made it. Okay, no argument there. We're right there with you. He established it and did not create it a waste place, but formed it to be inhabited. But what we're reading here is that he did create it formless. He did create it uninhabited. And yet Isaiah 45:18 is saying just the opposite. In other words, this is sought as evidence by a gap theorist that we're missing something here. In Genesis 1:2, what happened between 1:1 and 1:2? This became formless and void. What about 2 Peter 3:5? The heavens existed long ago and the earth was formed out of water and by water. What's this referring to? Creation. The heavens, the earth, formed out of water and by water. God separated the surface of the deep. Through which the world at that time was destroyed, being flooded with water. Now some people say, well, this refers to Noah's flood. What's the context? The context is creation, the earth being formed out of water, and at that time it was destroyed, being flooded with water, or the earth became formless and void. This could be that God saw that there was some kind of a rebellion. That could be Satan. That could be something else. So what was it? We don't know. That's the gap theorist's whole point. What happened in these billions or millions of years? We don't know. We're on a need-to-know basis, and we don't know. All we know is that it became formless and void, and that time it was destroyed. God brought judgment on it. The darkness of Genesis 1:2 refers to judgment, evil, or disorder. You read throughout your Bible, darkness is associated with judgment. It's associated with death, oppression, wickedness. And so when it says the darkness was over the surface of the deep, that would further support this idea. Just get the idea that it was there to symbolize evil and disorder under the gap theorist view. So under the view, let me say this one more time. You got Genesis 1:1. Let's just try and play this out. Genesis 1:1. Big Bang, 13.6 billion years ago, God created the heavens and the earth. That's metonymy. That's like me saying to my wife, honey, I love you from your head to your toes. God created the heavens and the earth. It's the whole material universe. Then you have an indiscriminate amount of time. Star formation, planet Earth is created, life. I mean, everything we see in the geological record, paleontology, paleoanthropology, all that's real. There could have been humans before us. We don't know. They went through some kind of a fall. You had the fall of Satan. And all this happened, and then God jumps in, Genesis 1:2, the earth became formless and void, and darkness was over the surface of the deep. God comes in and judges, and then he recreates the earth, or maybe even just a portion of it. And he creates Adam and Eve. Now you're like, well, what about all those humans that lived before Adam, before 8,000 years ago? That's just not part of our story. It's not with us. What about all those animals that died? Well, it's just not part of our story. Our story picks up 6,000 years ago, 8,000 years ago, maybe 10, maybe 12, maybe 25,000. We have no idea. The gap theorists, they're really hard to pin down. Because they're basically saying there was a gap and we don't know how long it was. The difficulty with this view, if I were to attack it, would be that there's very little scriptural support. I've read books on it. They cite 2 Corinthians 4:6. They cite Hebrews 11:3, that it was formed, which could be mended. Isaiah 40, the passages I showed you, I think, responsibly, I think are the best passages. but very little scriptural support. And as we've argued, if you're going to see a gap in a text, the burden of proof rests on you to show that. And we could argue most of the species created have been around for millions of years. This would be a difficulty for gap theorists because it seems to me that you see in the paleontology, you see a continuity of animal life. You see a continuity of humans. The gap theorist comes in and says, yeah, but when Genesis 1 and 2 is being described, a God could have just come into the Garden of Eden. He could have come into the land, the local land, and recreated a part of it, and we'd never know the difference. So maybe we're misreading that text. As I said, the gap theory seems really strange to interpreters. However, it's really difficult to find out what's wrong with it. Even if you don't buy the grammatical argument that the earth became formless and void, you have to agree there's a gap between 1:1 and 1:2 because God created in the perfect completed tense. There is a gap. What's wrong with it? I remember I was arguing with my buddy about this. I was like, I don't like the gap theory. He's like, why? I'm like, because it just ties everything up into a nice, neat little bow, you know, like a little cherries on top. It answers everything. To which he replied, that's usually the sign of a good theory, that it has explanatory scope and explanatory power. It explains everything. All right, let's think of another view. This is a view held by Meredith Klein, Old Testament scholar. Oh boy, I don't know how to pronounce his name. He wrote a pretty good book on Genesis. If he's French, it's Henri Blocher. If he's from Texas, it's Henry Blocher, Bruce Waltke, and Gordon Wenham. These are all pretty well-renowned Old Testament scholars. Although Bruce Waltke gave up his view since his last writing on Genesis and has embraced theistic evolution and had to resign from his seminary where he taught as a result. But his commentary on Genesis I still find to be very interesting to read. Under this view, the literary framework view, days 1 through 6 aren't chronological. It's not day 1, day 2, day 3, day 4, day 5, day 6. It's that these are created or set thematically or topically by theme. And there's what's called chiasmus. It's not what your country can do for you. It's what you can do for your country. Country, you, country. A, B, B, A. And there's some kind of a chiastic structure, they would argue, to Genesis 1, that days match up with one another. Now, as soon as you say, well, that's wild, that you would have all the days out of order and everything's all screwed up and how is that supposed to fit with anything, they would argue, well, this is just supposed to show that God did historically create all these different things, and yet it's just Genesis isn't a science textbook, and it's supposed to be read thematically, not chronologically, one after another. They would point out that there's other parts of Scripture which are historical in their genre, such as the Gospel of Matthew. In Matthew, chapters 8 and 9, Matthew captures a bunch of Jesus' miracles thematically, topically. He lumps them all together. So Jesus is Matthew 8 and 9, bang, 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 doing all these miracles to get you from Jesus' sermon to the next sermon. And so, too, they would argue in Genesis 1 that these are arranged thematically. How are they arranged? Well, namely by the theme found in Genesis 1-2, that the earth was formless, no form, and void. So no filling. So day 1, God creates the form. He creates light from darkness. And then he fills that on day 4 with the sun, the moon, and the stars. On day 2, he creates the form, the clouds, the sea, and the sky. On day 5, in parallel, in the clouds, sea, and sky, he creates the birds and the fish. Day 3, he creates the form of land and ocean, separating these two. And day 6, he creates animals and humans. And so do you see the connection? They would say we're seeing forming and filling And day 1 lines up with day 4, day 2 lines up with day 5, day 3 lines up with day 6. What's the problem with this view? It doesn't quite match up. For instance, day 3, God separates the land from the ocean. And what corresponds to this? Day 6, he creates animals and humans. Where's the ocean part? Nowhere. So it doesn't quite match up the way one would expect. And 2, is it really equivalent to Matthew 8 and 9, where Matthew has a string of miracles that are topically arranged in a historical genre? When you have ordinal numbers, day 1, day 2, day 3, day 4, day 5, day 6, the first day, the second day, the third day, and we're supposed to take these out of order, how different would it be if Matthew said, first, Jesus healed the leper. Second, he healed the hemorrhaging woman. Third, he raised the little girl from the dead. Fourth, and then we said that's topically arranged. That's a hard hermeneutical pill to swallow there. There's some difficulty, to be sure, with this view. And then we'll go real quickly through these. There's the six-day revelatory view of Genesis. This is the view that the days of Genesis 1 through 6 correspond to Moses receiving the revelation of creation. So under this view, which is held by Bernard Ramm, P.J. Wiseman, and his brother Donald Wiseman, under this view, it goes something like this. Moses, Exodus 19 and 20, goes up on Mount Sinai. And on the first day of the week, Moses goes up on Mount Sinai on the first day, and God's like, Moses, I gotta tell you something. Moses is like, what? He's like, in the beginning I separated light from darkness. And Moses is like, whoa. And then there was evening, and then there was morning the first day. And then Moses comes back on the second day, and he's like, God, tell me more. And he's like, well, on the second day, I can't remember what happens on the second day. What is it? Yeah. God's like, Moses, then I created the sky and the sea. And Moses is like, whoa, ho, ho. And then Moses went to sleep. It was evening and morning on the second day. And then day number 3, he creates the land and the ocean. He's like, Moses, I created the land and the ocean. And Moses is like, whoa, that's an incredible revelation, revelatory, 6-day revelatory. And there was evening and morning on the third day. You guys getting the idea? So the 6 days have nothing to do with creation. They have everything to do with Moses. What he heard, what God did. What's the problem with this view? Nothing in the text supports it. Nothing in the text says God said to Moses. Now, do we read of parts in the Bible where God speaks directly to Moses? All over the Old Testament, or all over the Pentateuch, the first 5 books. But do we read it in Genesis 1? No. We don't even see Moses in Genesis 1. Nothing about Revelation. Then there's another view, which is referred to as the divine fiat from heaven. Fiat, let it be said, a direction, an order from God. A divine God fiat. Command. This view is held by Alan Hayward. It focuses on God's decree. So on day 1, God said, let there be light, and it was so. So the focus has less to do with what's happening on planet Earth or in the material universe. It has more to do with God commanding creation from heaven. On the second day, he said, let there be this, and it was so. And on the third day, he said, let there be this, and it was so. However, the order of the days and the events in which these things were created aren't really that important because the focus of Genesis 1 is on God, not on the planet Earth. God is the main character. That's another view. There's problems with it. Yes, God is the main character, but is that all we're supposed to get out of Genesis 1? Nothing else? What about Genesis 2? How does it solve any of the issues there? Then there's the kingdom covenant view. This really isn't a problem for anybody. God makes a suzerainty treaty with the first humans. Humans are his vassals or his petty kings. He gives them dominion. And that's really the whole focus of Genesis 1, is that it's a suzerainty treaty. Now, are there suzerainty treaties in the Old Testament where a king gets a vassal and he gives him land and says, you take over it as a steward and you work for me now? Yes. Yes, 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 we have those. For example, the law is a suzerainty treaty. It matches other suzerainty treaties between kings and vassals in the second millennium BC. The problem with this view is that's all Genesis 1 is saying. That's all it has to say. It's not that this view is wrong necessarily. It just doesn't say anything about the subject of creation. Then there is the functional view. This is held by John Walton. If you see any of his books, I'm totally blanking. Oh, The Lost World of Genesis, or The Lost World of Adam and Eve, or The Lost World of the Flood. Any lost world that isn't Michael Crichton is John Walton, and he's an Old Testament scholar, and he argues that Genesis isn't about creation, it's about function. God created the sun and the moon, but why did he create them? He created them for showing the times and seasons and days and years. So as a Westerner today, you're so focused on causation and creation and existence and metaphysics, but to an ancient Hebrew person, says Walton, they weren't concerned with any of that. They were just concerned with the function of the different things that existed. Well, there have just been endless critiques of John Walton. If you want a great critique of Walton, pick up John Lennox's book, 7 Days That Divide the World. He has a whole appendix devoted to just ripping Walton's thesis apart. But it's not hard to find. Another view held by John Salehammer is that when we're reading Genesis 1, it uses the word earth, but that could just mean land. It's the Hebrew word eretz. And the Hebrew word eretz could be translated land or earth or globe or planet earth. So when Genesis 1 says that God created the heavens and the earth, okay, in the beginning, Salehammer would say beginning refers to like the first moment in a succession, but not like an absolute beginning. That's how he gets around that. And then he says, the earth was formless and void. That could be the land. And then he starts to fill the land, and this could just be maybe the Garden of Eden, or maybe the land of Israel. That's another option. Seems to be narrowing the scope far too much. His whole semantic argument for the beginning only being the beginning of a succession doesn't hold much weight either. It is an absolute beginning, and I could talk your ear off about that, but you don't care. All right, so now we've come to the end of 9 or arguably 10 different views about Genesis 1 and 2. 10, I say, if you include theistic evolution. So which view is true? There's some views that I'll say I don't believe are true. John Walton's view, I don't believe is true. The divine fiat view, I don't believe is true. Young earth creationism, I don't believe is true. Theistic evolution, I don't believe is true. But there's a lot of different views on there, aren't there? If you were really to pull out the pincers and really force me to give my answer as to which view I hold, I would say Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, I hold to old earth day age creationism. Thursday, Friday, Saturday, I hold to gap theory. 6 hours out of Sunday, I think it could be literary framework view. And then maybe the rest of those 18 hours of Sunday, either sleeping or just not even thinking about it. So you're going to have to decide on your own time which view you hold to. If I could give you a little bit of wisdom, it would be this. You weren't there. You don't know because you weren't there. And there are a number of responsible, careful readings of the text which fit with inerrancy and also which fit with the natural sciences quite well. And so in my view, I like to hold this with a really open hand and say there's some views that I'm like, nope, 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 and no, and really no. But there's enough views that I would remain agnostic and just say, I don't know. It could be this view, it could be that view, it could be the other view. And it strikes me as a little bit too dogmatic to come down on one view rather than another.